Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a recorded show for you, but a very special show with probably one of our most popular guests we've ever had on Media Matters, Amy Goodman. We're going to have a tape of the speech she gave here on campus in May 2005 at the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? If you didn't hear the talk, or even if you did hear it, it's one you're going to want to hear. But first, before we go to Amy Goodman's talk, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A broad coalition of groups from across the political spectrum representing more than 15 million Americans is mobilizing to stop a proposed corporate email tax courtesy of America Online. AOL, in conjunction with a service called Goodmail, plans to begin charging people who send bulk messages a premium to guarantee their delivery. Yahoo is considering a similar implementation. The companies claim charging to send email is a good way to fight spam, but Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, which got its start via email, says the AOL plan does nothing in this regard.
It will just enable spammers who won't be able to be detected well and will draw resources from regular everyday abuse handling.
Not-for-profit and charitable organizations, which rely heavily on email to keep their members informed, stand to take a huge hit financially if they must pay for what until now has been a very cost-effective channel of information dissemination. That's why Gils Friedman with the Association of Cancer Online Resources says groups like the Human Rights Campaign, United Farm Workers, and the Humane Society all oppose AOL's email tax.
Our members are AOL members too. The average organization that has a mailing list has about 20% to 25% of its membership on AOL email addresses.
Although AOL has hinted that the service is targeted at commercial mass emailers, Eli Pariser with MoveOn.org says he's seen nothing to suggest it won't catch everyone who mass mails.
That's the implicit assumption behind all of this, that either you pay to play or you take your chances with their spam filters.
A big picture view of the proposal is even more disturbing. Danny O'Brien with the Electronic Frontier Foundation says charging for sending email is just a step closer toward doing away with principles of network neutrality, which guarantees the free flow of information online.
It introduces the machinery to tax individual emails. Ostensibly, for very good reasons, but you really don't know where this kind of thing leads. As soon as you put a spike onto the internet where you can draw out money, any number of middlemen realize that they can take a cut too.
For now, the coalition is pointing its members and the public to a new website, DearAOL.com, where it's posted an open letter to America Online asking it to reconsider its paymail plan. But many coalition members, like Larry Pratt of the Gun Owners of America, say they won't hesitate to ramp up the pressure on AOL through other means, like boycotts, if necessary.
I would say that if AOL actually, if you'll pardon the expression, pulls the trigger on this plan, then that would be our response.
For its part, AOL says it's undeterred by the criticism and still plans to roll out its paymail scheme sometime this month.
Renowned linguist and social critic Noam Chomsky has harsh words for the state of media coverage about Iraq. But the MIT professor emeritus is not focusing on bias, embedded reporting, or the growing military propaganda machine, both at home and abroad. He says journalists avoid asking questions that are both simple and troubling, like whether the occupation of Iraq has lost its legitimacy or had any legitimacy to begin with. Instead, Chomsky says U.S. journalists treat the occupation much like a high school newspaper would cover a football game.
Questions do come up, critical questions too. For example, how are we doing? Could we do better if we tried another way? Should we get a different coach? Put in a different player or something like that. But the question whether it's legitimate to be there and to win, that's unimaginable.
The problem, according to Chomsky, is that the answers to such questions tread on uncomfortable territory. For example, the torture of prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison and the decimation of the city of Fallujah are clear violations of the Geneva Conventions on warfare.
Under U.S. law, every top leader is not only subject to a trial, but in fact the death penalty. That's the penalty for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. Does it matter? No. We're doing it, so it must be right. Only problem is, does it work or does it cost too much?
Chomsky says ignoring the brutal facts of U.S. warfare erodes claims of moral superiority in the war on terror. And the mainstream media, complicit in the ignorance, loses its own moral claim of being truth-tellers as a result.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a pre-recorded show for you, a really terrific show. We have the speech that Amy Goodman gave in May 2005 at the Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation Conference held right here on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. Amy Goodman was in town. She gave one of the plenary addresses. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. I think you'll be delighted you took time to listen to today's program.
Well, it is a great honor to be here at this conference and also to be here in Urbana-Champaign, which really is, I don't know if we would call it a breeding ground, but a gold mine of independent media activity. It really is an example of the hope for the future as we talk about how important it is that we have independent media. And then, coming to this place that really is the site of support for indie media all over this country. I mean, we all know about the IMCs, the Indie Media Centers, the most important beginning, 1999, the day of the, or the days of wrath in Seattle, the Battle of Seattle, when 50,000 people across the political spectrum from nurses and doctors and farmers and environmentalists and trade unionists and students, high school kids and college kids took to the streets in the largest export city in this country. Then Boeing was there, Microsoft and Amazon.com and other large corporations. And people were beginning to learn, just like they didn't know about the FCC, who would have thought that anyone would care about this quite secret bureaucratic organization called the World Trade Organization, born in Geneva in 1995, that was overturning the laws of democratically elected legislatures in this country and around the world. If corporations lost at the city council level or at a state legislature level, for example, if a community said, we don't want to do business with a company doing business with the Indonesian military or the Burmese regime, when corporations lost at that level, they could overturn it at the World Trade Organization level and say it's an illegal barrier to trade. And so people started to get wise to this, or people concerned about their food supply and whether it was bioengineered or, you know, whether hormones were being injected into the beef. Okay, maybe you couldn't beat it at the local level. And so you moved in at a supranational level at the World Trade Organization. And people said no, and it was this remarkable global uprising against corporate power. But there was also this group of people who were part of that who said, we are not going to view this global uprising against corporate power through a corporate lens. And so people got out their papers and their pencils and their tape recorders and their pens and their video cameras, and they took to the streets too. And that's where really the blossoming of the indie media movement, indiemedia.org, was born. And when people got tear gas with their video cameras, they handed them off to someone else, or they got arrested and they got taken away. And all of these images went on the website and all of the firsthand accounts. And as the mayor and the police chief were saying, we're not shooting rubber bullets, we're picking them up by the handfuls in the streets. as they're acting as a megaphone for those in power, as the city of Seattle is closed down for only the second time, martial law in that city since World War II. And the Indy Media Center started to get more hits than CNN.com. And it was a mighty force to contend with. And here, amazingly enough, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, the sponsor of many Indy Media Centers from Washington to Boston to New York, all over the country, the site here, and as this Indy Media Center grew, I came here a few years ago and I saw it was a lovely space that people came to for concerts and information, and now, this week, hearing that the Indy Media Center has bought the post office. And a low-power FM station, Radio Free Urbana, is going to be going on the air next month, and it's also the site of Indy Media and so much more, talking about the post office, talking about sending the message around the world that Indy Media is on the move. Yes, I'm very proud to be here right now. Well, I come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded 56 years ago by a man named Lou Hill, who was a conscientious objector in World War II. And when he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. Not run by corporations, as George Gerbner at the Annenberg School, University of Pennsylvania, says, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so the first Pacifica station, KPFA, went on air in 1949 in Berkeley. Second one, 10 years later, in Los Angeles, KPFK. Third one, my station, WBAI, in New York in 1960. WPFW in Washington in 1977. KPFT in Houston, 1970. KPFT is the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up not once but twice in the first year of operation by the Ku Klux Klan. And I don't know if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but when they took credit, they said it was their proudest act, because they understood how dangerous Pacifica is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, that breaks down the caricatures and the stereotypes that fuel the bigotry that feed these groups. I really do think that the Abu Ghraib prison scandal began long before the first low-level soldier laid a finger on the first Iraqi prisoner. I mean, yes, there's the chain of command, and I always talk about Cy Hirsch's expose of this everywhere I go and how important it was. And I was recently speaking in Tampa Bay, the home of CENTCOM, Central Command, and MacDill Air Base, and also wonderful community media. WMNF, a Florida community radio station that has now built a station three times its size in their parking lot, because indie media, independent media, is on the move, and Speak Up Tampa Bay, public access in Tampa Bay, both of those together forming a very important source, well, of information. So there you've got indie media, you've got CENTCOM, you've got MacDill Air Base. And after giving the talk and talking about the chain of command and how everyone should read Cy Hirsch's book, a woman came up to me, because I was saying, you know, you have to look at the chain of command. Now, Human Rights Watch, by the way, has come out with a report and a demand calling for a special prosecutor to investigate particularly Donald Rumsfeld and the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, saying Alberto Gonzalez can't do this. And this woman comes up to me and she says, why don't you refer to it as the Cheney of command? Maybe that will be Cy's next book. But anyway, but it goes beyond the chain of command. And yes, that must be investigated to the very top. And Alberto Gonzalez can't do it. Yes, the man who's become attorney general, who really laid the legal groundwork for the torture at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib by saying that the Geneva Conventions don't apply, that they're quaint. And by the way, one of the most important stories that isn't covered in this country is the level of resistance in the military. from the lowest levels to the highest levels. A couple months ago, we had Brigadier General James Cullen in our studio. He was one of those generals and admirals who had sent a letter to the Senate committee that was going to vote out to confirm Alberto Gonzalez, saying he is a threat to the servicemen and women of this country. Now, that's a very important story, because if this is how people are treated who are imprisoned by the United States, what will happen to U.S. servicemen and women if they're caught in other parts of the world? And on that point, I want to follow this thread of thought, but we've been on this Unembed the Media tour for a couple months now. Unembed the media, by the way. That is what we have to do. More powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile, the Pentagon has deployed the U.S. media, and we have to unembed it. The media are the most powerful institutions on Earth. But on this tour, I was down in Tucson just about a week ago on the border and talking at the convention center. And at the convention center hotel the next morning, there's this group of older men, and they're all wearing military caps and everything. They had just celebrated the night before, April 29th, the 60th anniversary of their liberation from German POW camps. They were held by the Luftwaffe. They were the airmen who were shot down. They were the guys that were strafing the radar so that the bombardiers wouldn't get shot down. And they had just had this big dinner the night before. Oh, they decided on their motto. You know, they're getting older, no question. Their motto is, they're concerned, are they going to even be able to have another celebration together, anniversary? Don't go to heaven till 07, because that's a big anniversary. But anyway, so they, so I went up to this guy with this cap on, and it said Tuskegee Airman, African-American survivor of the detention camp, had been shot down. His name is Alexander Jefferson, and he lives in Detroit. He just wrote a book about his experience. And I said, so what was it like? This is the 60th anniversary. What was it like in this POW camp? And he said, sure beat Mississippi. And he described coming in the ship he came into New York Harbor as a hero with the others who had been liberated. It was called the Lejeune. They came and they saw the Statue of Liberty, and they docked. They came down the gangplank, incredibly proud. They were coming home. They had survived. And a guy at the end said, whites to the left, niggers to the right. Then there was a guy, an airman named Irv Baum. And he's from Napa, California. And he was standing next to Alexander Jefferson. And I said, what do you think about what's happening at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib? And he said, the Geneva Conventions are the only thing that saved us. And he said, when he hears about this, when he sees the pictures, he can only think SS. He said, they were lucky enough to be held by the Luftwaffe, believe it or not, the German Air Army. He said, because at least they respected the Geneva Conventions once you got into this camp. He said, but if you fell into the hands of the SS, tortured, shot, killed. And he said, that's all he can think of every time he hears these descriptions. And he too said what Brigadier General James Cullen said. He said, this is a threat to the servicemen and women of this country. What is going to happen to them? Just another story that we don't hear. We hear about their stories of being survivors of POW camps, as we should. But what these men actually have to say beyond the real life experiences, these are not theoretical concepts, Geneva Conventions. It's what saves lives. But talking about the torture beginning before the first low-level soldier laid a finger on the Iraqi prisoner, It's not just the chain of command to the top that has to be investigated. We have to look at the media culture in this country, because I think somehow some of these soldiers felt like they had a kind of permission. Where from? Well, we live in a media culture where the average soundbite 6, 7, 8, 9 seconds. What can be said in that amount of time? You can say Saddam Hussein is like Hitler, and you're ready for prime time. Takes about 4 seconds. Everyone knows what you're talking about. If you have something else to say, perhaps that U.S. officials might be guilty of war crimes, actually, that takes less than 8 seconds, but you sound crazy. Because that you don't often hear on television. And so you need to explain yourself. What are the Geneva Conventions? What are the Nuremberg Principles? What are war crimes? And for that, you do not have time. It's not a political edit, they say. You're just not quite there yet. And that's true for so many issues. I've been invited on Hardball a few times, believe it or not, MSNBC. Often they have me on to talk about the occupation, or at least they say that's what I'll be invited on to talk about. But it always changes once you get there. And it's usually never the topic you come in to speak about. And you only have 3 minutes to talk about this new issue. I seem to have become their Social Security expert. I am not sure why. And it's funny, I bumped into Katrina Vandenhoevel. I was coming out, once again, a little shell-shocked from the experience. And she was going in. She said she had told herself she wasn't going to do it anymore because every time she comes in, they talk about a wholly different issue. So anyway, you know the experience, Bernie. I have become their Social Security expert, and so I think it is my responsibility to learn all the facts and figures, to talk about why, you know, this is not the kind of crisis they're talking about. And so I've become prepared, but I'm often put up against this right-wing pundit from the San Francisco Chronicle. And I don't like to say conservative, because I consider myself conservative in many ways. But, you know, right-wing pundit, who they had told me this time, one of these times, that I was going to come on and talk about the invasion, and then I got there, and I was talking about Social Security. I think she was surprised, too, because she had written an article about the occupation, fully in support of it. And I had read this article, and I had carefully noted what I was going to say. So we were both prepared for the fight. But instead, they asked us what we thought of Social Security. So we were both surprised. And she said that she something like, she cannot believe the way old people burden young people in this society. And, you know, I know the numbers, and I was just about to start spouting them, but I thought, oh, come on, everyone's eyes glaze over when you do that. I knew we only had a few minutes, so I didn't have time to ask her. I don't know what kind of relationship she has with her parents. So I quoted Gandhi. I thought that might be a little new to MSNBC. And I said, you know, he was asked the question, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it would be a good idea. And I said, what kind of society do you want to live in? I mean, the next thing she's going to say is these barbaric babies who burden their parents. But we have to break the sound barrier. And I really do think that all these political labels are breaking down right now. Conservative, liberal, they just don't apply when it comes to Social Security, when it comes to issues of privacy, when it comes to issues of corporate control and media consolidation. It was Trent Lott as well as Barbara Boxer that raked Michael Powell over the coals before their Senate committee. They know what happens when one media mogul in town who owns everything decides they don't like one of these politicians and targets them. And so I think it's very important not to assume immediately who your allies are, or rather who perhaps your political enemies are, because it may not be true. I think things are really turning around in this country. On one of these shows just a few weeks ago on Hardball, when I was brought back on to talk about, well, they at least told me this time, media coverage of the Terry Schiavo case. And that is what we talked about. But I decided that, I know I'm going to talk about the occupation no matter what happens. They're not going to be the one to frame this discussion because it was right after the second anniversary of the invasion, and I felt it was very important the media hardly touched this. So, you know, how to bring this around. So I sat in the studio in Washington, and I said, what do you think? You know what happened with Terry Schiavo. For 2 weeks, nonstop coverage in the corporate media of the Terry Schiavo case. Not to say it isn't a tragic, you know, story that too many of us will have to deal with. But you'd think we'd learn something in the 2 weeks of nonstop coverage. I was talking to someone who was in a meeting in France of international health workers from around the world dealing with malaria and TB. You know how many millions of people have died? They were all talking about the Terry Schiavo case. That's the power of the media. This one woman, she said she came to morning, noon, and night. Everyone was focused on whether she would live or die. And they were there to talk about whether millions would live or die. That is why we have to take the media back. It is a matter of life and death. But 2 weeks, would we get from this 2 weeks of coverage? And what matters is television, because that's where most people get their information, particularly from the late night comics. But why it's so important to build this independent media infrastructure that includes television and radio and the internet and all the different forms as we build it all together, collaborate together. But in that 2 weeks, did we learn, for example, that Tom DeLay, the man that led the charge for congressional intervention to cover up the charges against him, had made this painful decision himself in the late 80s with his brothers and his mom in the hospital when his father was in a coma from a freak accident in their backyard. They had decided not to continue any kind of artificial support for their father. And what about Mr. Schindler, Terry's dad, who made that very same decision for his own mother? She had gotten pneumonia, and he had made this painful decision that should be private, with his family, with his doctors. Did we learn about this? Did we learn who this small group of protesters who they focused on nonstop in front of the hospice? I'm not talking about the family. The small group of protesters led by Randall Terry, right, founder of Operation Rescue. I covered him for years in New York on the sidewalks as he blocked women's access to health care. I hardly recognized him. He was older, and the media didn't talk about him in that way. And they realized, oh, that's Randall Terry. I often wonder if Terry is short for terrorizing women. But there they were, and every time this small group of protesters went to the microphone, the media cut away, giving us the illusion that this country was deeply divided over this issue. It is not. The polls show that between 80 and 90% of Americans were against the congressional intervention, were against President Bush flying back in the middle of the night and signing off on the legislation in his pajamas, against. And that more than 60% of evangelicals were against this. The lines are breaking down, but instead we had this false sense of it's balanced, it's divided. Because when they were moved to go to a microphone, the networks cut away from their regularly scheduled programs. And so when they asked, what do I think of the media coverage of the Terry Schiavo case, I said, let it be a model for the coverage of all protest in this country. 2 weeks before the second anniversary of the invasion, March 19th, 800 protests around this country, tens of thousands of people marched, rallied, vigiled in tiny protests and in big protests. Outside Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina, thousands of people gathered. And people like Camilo Mejia spoke up, the Florida Army National Guardsman who went to Iraq, came back after 6 months, was on leave, and then refused to return, said he didn't want to be a part of the torture and abuse that he had witnessed himself, not at Abu Ghraib, but al-Assad, a place that Rumsfeld went to. He offered to testify before Congress. He applied for conscientious objector status. He wanted to talk about what he had experienced. Instead, he was the first soldier to be court-martialed for refusing to return to Iraq, and he served almost a year in the brig in prison. You have to ask, if we lived in a just society, who would be behind bars and who would be free? And now, Camila Mejia, together with Aiden Delgado, another soldier who said no, ultimately had his weapons taken away from him in Iraq, although he remained there and he was at Abu Ghraib and came back and bravely talked about what he had witnessed, have now flown to California to be with Pablo Paredes, who is being court-martialed tomorrow, the young U.S. Navy sailor in California who refused to get on the ship to be deployed to Iraq. And together they will stand. Naomi Klein is going there tomorrow, as they are going to hold a rally. The next day, Dr. Kenneth Benderman will be court-martialed. Same story, refusing, saying no. The level of resistance in the military that the Pentagon doesn't want you to know about. We should know these people's names. We should know their stories. And so there was the Florida Army National Guardsman, Camila Mejia, at Fort Bragg in New York. Javier Cosso was standing in Central Park with thousands of others. He lost his brother, Jose Cosso. He worked for Telecinco Television. He was at the Palestine Hotel on April 8th, remember, the day before the U.S. Marines pulled down the Saddam Hussein statue in Firdaus Square. And Jose Cosso was filming on the balcony. The U.S. military had first opened fire around the Al Jazeera offices, killing Tariq Ayoub, a young reporter for Al Jazeera, who had gone on the roof with the cameraman to fix the camera. And he was first killed. And then the military, the U.S. military, moved on Abu Dhabi and then over to the Palestine Hotel. And they opened fire. Now, everyone in the world knew who was in the Palestine Hotel. Hundreds of unembedded reporters. Sites were set on the 14th floor. And they opened fire, and Jose died. And Javier has come to this country to ask for an independent investigation into the killing of journalists in Iraq. Yes, for his brother Jose, but also for all reporters. And that protects us all. This idea of, or the question of, with the numbers that we're seeing. I mean, Al Jazeera saying they gave the coordinates of the Al Jazeera offices repeatedly to the military. Maybe that was their first mistake. But the whole question of shooting the messenger and how important it is that we all stand together in a journalistic gathering, that we ask the very serious questions about what is happening here. And so on the Terry Schiavo case that day, March 19th, 2 weeks before, why it's so important that we get these other voices out, why the protests aren't covered. I stayed home to watch the media coverage. I watched every nightly newscast March 19th on the anniversary of the invasion. Not one of them interviewed a protester. All the ingredients were there when you learn in journalism school, firsthand, closest to the story, right? Camila Mejia or Javier, who's speaking for his brother because he can no longer speak. Where were these people? CNN, by the end of the day, they did have a little riff that was going every 20 minutes or so. 4,000 people in Japan were protesting against war. Now, this is encouraging, but it wasn't CNN International. It was CNN Domestic. Right in their backyard, people were protesting. Where is the coverage? Where is the forum for those voices? It is absolutely critical. In the lead up to the invasion, FAIR did a study of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS, and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. In the 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving his address at the UN, his push for war. Four major nightly newscasts. There were 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war representatives, anti-war leaders. Three of almost 400. That is no longer mainstream media. That is an extreme media beating the drums for war. Mainstream media at that time, the majority of people were opposed to the invasion for more inspections and more diplomacy. This is why it is absolutely critical we take back the media. We are talking about voices that are being silenced that are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media.
Greetings, this is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. You're listening to a pre-recorded show. You're listening to a speech by Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, when she was in town in May 2005 speaking to the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Sit back and relax. Amy's talk is going to take up the entire program today.
I think it's very important when we look at the embedding of the media. Victoria Clark, who hailed from Hill and Knowlton, becomes the Pentagon spokesperson, hails the embedding process as a spectacular success. In fact, the media reached an all-time low, but it didn't just start now. We are moving in on the 60th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think it's instructive to go back to that time, to look at two reporters, one independent and one working for the New York Times, and how they covered the bombing, as this will get more and more attention, or at least the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki will on August 6th and August 9th. And as I travel around the country, there are major preparations for protest. I was in Omaha, Nebraska. Hundreds of people there for a Peace and Justice Expo. They'll be speaking out at STRATCOM, Strategic Command, from August 6th to August 9th, Los Alamos. That's going to be very big. In fact, already the Santa Fe City Council has passed a resolution for getting rid of nuclear weapons in the world, for abolition. And this is happening in city councils and in communities around the country. I want to look at just two reporters. One is Wilfred Burchett, independent reporter, and one is William Lawrence, the reporter for the New York Times. Wilfred Burchett, after the dropping of the bombs, wanted to see with his own eyes the dawn of the nuclear age. At the time, General MacArthur had declared the whole area of southern Japan off limits. Most of the press went off a barge off the coast of Japan to cover the Japanese surrender. But instead, he got on a train, and he traveled for 30 hours to Hiroshima, and was devastated by the devastation, saw people's shadows burnt in the sides of buildings, saw the skin melting off people's arms, saw people dying not from the initial impact, but from something else that he didn't even have the words to describe. And he sat down in the rubble with his Hermes typewriter, and he tapped out the words, "I write this as a warning to the world." It was a report that rocked the world, and the U.S. military had to deal with this very quickly. And so they called a group of reporters back to New Mexico, General Leslie Groves, who ran the Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb. Chief among those reporters was William Lawrence of the New York Times. The general was not disappointed with his reports. Lawrence's front page story, headlined, "U.S. Atom Bomb Site Belies Tokyo Tales. Tests on New Mexico Range Confirmed that Blast, Not Radiation, Took Toll." That ran on September 12, 1945, following a three-day delay to clear military censors. He said, "This historic ground in New Mexico, scene of the first atomic explosion on Earth and cradle of a new era in civilization, gave the most effective answer today to Japanese propaganda that radiation responsible for deaths even after the day of the explosion, August 6th, and that people entering Hiroshima had contracted mysterious maladies due to persistent radioactivity." In the course of the tour, by the way, General Groves' driver, a 29-year-old soldier named Patrick Stout, posed in the center of a bomb crater for photographs. A scientist later informed Stout he'd been exposed to high levels of radiation. He died of leukemia in 1969 and was given service-connected disability payments by the Army in apparent recognition that radiation was the cause. But Lawrence's words were quite amazing as he described the dawn of the nuclear age. By the way, he was in the squadron that dropped the bombs on Nagasaki, William Lawrence. He said, describing the bombing of Nagasaki, "Awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the Earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being born right before our incredulous eyes." He said, "Being close to it and watching it as it was being fashioned into a living thing so exquisitely shaped that any sculptor would be proud to have created it, one felt oneself in the presence of the supernatural." He wrote a series of 10 articles about the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for those reports. It turned out that he was also on the payroll of the Pentagon. Yes, William Lawrence, just before this, had been approached by General Leslie Groves. In March 45, Groves went to the New York Times and held a secret meeting with Lawrence to offer him a job writing press releases for the Manhattan Project, the U.S. program to develop atomic weapons. The intent was to explain the intricacies of the atomic bomb's operating principles in layman's language, said the Times. Lawrence also helped write statements on the bomb for President Truman and Secretary of War Henry Stimson. We've called for the New York Times to be stripped of this Pulitzer. It is very important that we unembed the media and challenge the models of a media that is a part of the powers it is supposed to cover. There is a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we are supposed to be the check and balance on government. We are supposed to be holding those in power accountable. And when we look at Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, who tried to launch the largest media consolidation this country has ever seen. His father helps to lead the war in Iraq. The son leads the war on diversity of voices here at home. We have to acknowledge that militarism and media monopoly go hand in hand, and we have to break the unholy alliance. I just wanted to end briefly with two more stories about the power of how we can get word out, how independent media really can break the sound barrier if we work together. One is the story of Haiti, which is very much on my mind today, as Yvonne Neptune, the ousted Haitian prime minister, lies near death, jailed since last June, February 2004. The Haitian president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, ousted in what he called a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Today, for those of you who listen to or watch Democracy Now!, you heard our hour interviewing President Aristide in exile in South Africa. But it is a story that has to continue to be told. This country in crisis connected us to us, unfortunately, through the barrel of a gun, and through U.S. foreign policy. It should be celebrating now. 2004 was its jubilee year. 200 years, the oldest black republic in the world, born of a slave uprising in 1804. The U.S. Congress not wanting to recognize the republic for decades, afraid it would inspire slaves in this country to rise up. And then, just after President Aristide was first elected, the first democratically elected leader in Haiti in 2001, he's ousted in a coup that lasts for 3 years. One of the leaders of that coup, FRAP leader Emmanuel Constant, who walks free in the streets of New York today, on the payroll of the U.S. intelligence agencies as he was involved in that coup. Alan Nairn, a great journalist, exposed this in The Nation magazine on the payroll of the DIA. And I raise that because the number two man in FRAP at that time was Louis Jodel Chamblain, who now, 10 years later, is involved in the coup once again against the reelected President Aristide. On March 1st last year, We didn't know what happened to Aristides that weekend. We had just interviewed the First Lady of Haiti, Mildred Aristide, on Friday, February 27, 2004. She said, we're not going to leave. And then they disappeared. Then we got a call from Congressmember Maxine Waters and Randall Robinson of TransAfrica. They said the Aristides had just called them. They were in the Central African Republic. According to the U.S. media, if they even covered it, somehow they had taken up residence there. But they said that Aristides said he'd been kidnapped, and he said that the U.S. was behind it. And so we put this story on the air, and our transcripts we put on our website at democracynow.org, and corporate network reporters took those transcripts to the Pentagon and the White House. Rumsfeld was at the Pentagon press briefing that day, and they asked him, is it true what Pacifica's reporting? And he laughed, and then he said, that's ridiculous. But I've learned in my years as a reporter, when a politician says that's ridiculous, you're probably on the right track. And then 2 weeks later, the small delegation led by Robinson and Congressmember Waters decided to charter a small plane and go two-thirds of the way around the world to the Central African Republic to pick up the Aristides, calling the bluff of the most powerful country on earth, the United States, saying they were free to go. Well, if they were free to go, then they would take them home. And so I chronicled this trip. We got on a plane in Miami, went from there to St. Thomas, across the Atlantic to Dakar, Senegal, to the Central African Republic, where they went to negotiate with the dictator, Bazize, who was himself celebrating the first anniversary of his coup. The U.S. really knows how to choose them. And as the delegation negotiated with him for 7 hours, President Aristide said to me, Wes Bazize says he's considering their offer. He's really going off to get his marching orders from the United States and France. And finally, they had no choice. If they weren't being held in captivity, they had to let them go. And so they did. And as this was all unfolding, AP would take all of the reports from our satellite phone and put them out around the world. And then we got back on the plane and made our way back from Central African Republic to Dakar, Senegal, to the Cape Verde Islands across the Atlantic. And there, President Aristide told his story. As we flew over the Atlantic, he said, on February 29th, the number two men in the U.S. Embassy in Haiti came to their home and said that they could die, thousands of Haitians could die, if they didn't leave immediately. He said he wanted to speak to the press, thought he was being taken to the press. Instead, he was hustled onto this plane with U.S. military and security, with Mildred Aristide. They were told not even to lift the shade to know where they were going. They traveled for some 24 hours and ended up dumped in this remote area of Africa where it was difficult to get a cell phone call out, let alone leave. And so we arrived in Barbados, and as we were landing in Barbados, we were getting word that Rumsfeld, Rice, and Powell were saying the Aristides were not to return to this hemisphere. Whose hemisphere? And that the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, James Foley, was saying Aristide was not to come within 150 miles of Haiti. Whose country? And then we arrived in Jamaica, where they'd been invited by P.J. Patterson, the prime minister, who's also head of CARICOM, which has never accepted the new, quote, de facto government of Haiti, led by Gerard Latortue. And as they landed, I talked to CNN on the phone, and they said they were going to go live with the report. I said, let me bring over Congressmember Waters. They said, no. The host is doing some kind of lifestyle show. He's not going to know what you're talking about. Just explain what's happened. And I think he thought I was doing some vacation report, because he said, so what's happening in Jamaica? We're on the tarmac at the airport. And I said, well, this historic delegation has just arrived. The Aristides have been returned to this hemisphere. And you could see in his other ear, you could tell that he's now being quickly informed about what's going on. And he suddenly says, what about the violence? You know, suggesting that Aristide would inspire violence if he came to this hemisphere. I said, I'm very glad that you raised that issue, the violence. Who is involved with this coup? Who is the U.S. working with? For example, Jodel Chamblain, the number two man in FRAP, involved in the coup 10 years ago, found guilty in absentia of the murder of the Justice Minister Guy Mallory in 1993, found guilty in absentia of the murder of a Haitian businessman named Antoine Ismery. I had spent time at his house. Incredibly brave man who marched in a procession during the coup, remembering a massacre that had taken place 5 years before on another September 11th. And as he marched in the midst of the coup of 1993 with a small group of people, he was brought behind a church, pushed to his knees, and in cold blood, in broad daylight, he was executed. Jodel Chamblain was found guilty of that murder in absentia. These are the people who are working with the U.S. government. And the host said from CNN, "You're kidding." Sometimes it's good to get into those non-political shows. And then CBS was taking the reports all through that 40 hours radio throughout the country. And I use this as an example from AP to Reuters to CNN that this is what I call trickle-up journalism. We can get the story out if we work together. If we build this independent media infrastructure in this country, it really can make a difference. And in the 2 minutes that I have remaining, I'm going to raise Timor. And I know that I've told many of you this story before. You've either heard it from Noam Chomsky or you've heard it from Pacifica Radio. But the reason that I'm raising it is because it unfortunately is relevant once again, and that is the brutality of the Indonesian military. Because of what happened on December 26, the tsunami. Now, that was a natural catastrophe. And by the way, the media did the right thing in that case. They raced to the area to tell us the stories of the people, and it proves once again that it doesn't matter if people are red, black, yellow, or white. If we see their faces, if we know their names, if we see the orphan kids or the women or men who are suffering, people all over the world care. It doesn't matter where they are. The outpouring of support was because the media spotlight was focused in the right place. But what they didn't show is the second tsunami that the people of this area in Indonesia have had to suffer through quite a long period of time. And that's the area Aceh. If you said that word before December 26, someone would probably say, God bless you. But afterwards, we learned about this area. 200,000 people died as a result of the tsunami. But more were killed after December 26 by the Indonesian military. And that has gone on for years. They've declared that whole area a state of siege. It's also where ExxonMobil has one of the largest gas fields operates in the world, and that's very much connected to the Indonesian military there, and a group of human rights groups and church groups have called for transparency, that it should be very clear who ExxonMobil is paying to protect its gas fields. I know well the brutality of the Indonesian military, having survived the massacre in Timor in 1991 when the Indonesian military moved in on defenseless protesters. You know the story of Timor, 1975, Kissinger and Ford give the go-ahead for the invasion. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States, this small country 300 miles above Australia, and they closed Timor to the outside world, and they carried out a slaughter, one of the great genocides of the 20th century. I got a chance to go there in 90 and 91. I was there with my colleague Alan Nairn. He was writing for The New Yorker. I was doing a documentary for Pacifica. And on November 12, 91, we were covering a procession of people honoring yet another young man who'd been killed by the military. We covered them marching from the church to the cemetery. When they got to the cemetery, there were thousands of them. We saw the Indonesian military march up. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. They were marching up on girls in their Catholic school uniforms, women in their traditional Timorese garb, boys in their school shorts. The people couldn't get away because there were walls on either side of the road. The soldiers marched up 12 to 15 abreast, carrying their US M16s at the ready position. Alan and I walked to the front of the crowd. We knew they had committed many massacres in the past, but never in front of Western journalists. So we took out our equipment, though we'd always hidden it so as not to endanger Timorese talking to us. And I put on my headphones, held my microphone up like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head. We thought, if they saw Western journalists, maybe we could head off this attack. The soldiers marched up 12 to 15 abreast, carrying their US M16s. They swept around the corner. Without warning, without hesitation, without provocation, they swept past us and they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. They beat us to the ground. Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me, and they took their US M16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. They were killing everyone around us. They then put the guns to our heads and they screamed two things, Australia and politique. Politique because they were saying we were political to witness this, but that's our job as journalists to go to where the silence is. And they were saying, screaming, Australia. They were demanding to know if we were from Australia. That's because 17 years before, when Indonesia invaded, there were 6 Australia-based journalists covering the invasion. They immediately executed 5 of them. The 6th, Roger East, was reporting from a radio station in Dili for the world. The Indonesian military dragged him out of the radio station. Radio is so important as a form of mass communication, the most important form of communication in the world. It's why in Haiti they ransack the radio stations if they play musique engagée, you know, political music. It is the place, the most accessible form of communication. So they drag Roger East out and he shouts, "I'm from Australia, I'm from Australia." They shoot him into the harbor, December 8, 75, the day after the invasion, with so many thousands of Timorese. The Australian government hardly protested. We believe because years later, Australia and Indonesia would sign the Timor Gap Treaty, dividing up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain in the world. And so on that day, November 12, 91, as we lay on the ground, Alan, covered in blood, the firing squad of soldiers with the guns at our heads, we shouted back, "No, we're from America." They'd stripped us now of everything. The only thing I had left was my passport. We kept shouting, "America, America." They became convinced of this, and they pulled the guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from. They would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese. And they moved on. We got into a Red Cross Jeep. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us to escape this killing field, and we drove as a human mass to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. We believe because of 2 things, what we represent to the people of Timor, all of us as Americans, and not just to the people of Timor, but to people all over the world. We represent the sword and the shield. The sword, because all too often the U.S. government provides regimes, repressive regimes, with weapons or uses them themselves, like in Iraq. But we as the American people also represent the shield. We come from the most powerful country on earth. Every little act we engage in has a ripple effect all over the world. And on that day, November 12, 91, they saw that shield bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. Alan, 10 years later, when the people of East Timor celebrated their freedom, May 20th, 2002, we got into Timor, 100,000 Timorese gathered in a sandy plain outside Dili. It was an incredible moment. As the clock struck midnight, Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, gave his speech, and then Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, got up, the founding president of East Timor, and he unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. The people looked up, and there was this fireworks display, and you could see the light in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted, and they had won at an unbelievably high price, 1/3 of their population wiped out, a genocide proportionately worse than Cambodia. But they had won. And they thanked people all over the world. They knew they couldn't do it alone. Sure, they were the bravest. They were on the front lines. They bore the brunt of the pain. But they thanked people, especially in the most powerful countries, for demanding that their governments turn those weapons away, stop supporting human rights abusing regimes. And it is a lesson to all of us, whether we are journalists or politicians, whether we're librarians, students, professors, whether we are artists, shopkeepers, farmers, whether we are employed or unemployed. We have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, and that is whether to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now!